This is Apologetics Profile, a podcast ministry of Watchman Fellowship, equipping the church, exhorting the non-believer, and exalting Christ.
Roman prefect Pontius Pilate, governor of Judea, was deeply troubled about what to do with Jesus. The crowds wanted him crucified, but Pilate found no fault in him. Who was this king of the Jews? Why were the Jews crying out for his death? Pilate's wife had a dream about Jesus, which troubled her as well. Matthew records, quote, "And while he, Pilate, was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent to him, saying, 'Have nothing to do with that righteous man, for last night I suffered greatly in a dream because of him.'" End quote. At one point, Pilate asks Jesus, "What is truth?" If Jesus did directly answer his question, none of the gospel accounts recorded it. Of course, John's account tells us that prior to his being brought to Pilate, Jesus proclaims that he is the way, the truth, and the life. But if you reject Jesus, where do you turn? Many philosophers over the centuries have grappled with this very question and still grapple with it today. From the ancient Greeks and Romans to the Enlightenment rationalists of the 18th century to postmodern philosophers of the 19th and 20th centuries, the question of what is truth remains a hot topic of debate. As the French philosopher Etienne Gilson has observed in his book, The Unity of Philosophical Experience, quote, "Independent philosophy has failed to produce a single constructive doctrine which would act as a rule of public order and private morality." End quote. As philosophy goes, one of the current dominant theories of truth is called the correspondence theory. It is the belief that truth is simply that which corresponds to reality. If we take reality to mean that the physical world and all it contains, all things visible and invisible, as the creation of God, for and through our Lord Jesus Christ, then truth is that which corresponds to what God has created and revealed to us through the physical world, through His Word, and through His Son. Adherents of the correspondence theory will say that the antithesis of correspondence is an attack on common sense and external reality. If, for example, one wants to consider reality as nothing more than a matrix simulation or some sort of alien or atomically induced illusion, then all claims to objective truth go out the window, if even there is such a thing as a window. In other words, correspondence theory is a common sense-based understanding of truth. Why would anyone want to rail against common sense and our physical external reality? Because, as authors Stuart Kelly and our guest again this week, Jamie Dew, suggest in their 2017 book, Postmodernism, A Christian Primer, quote, "If we don't like the world as it is, then we can simply choose to create, invent a different one, more to our liking, and the common postmodern tendency toward anti-realism, the denial that there is an external and mind-independent reality, is a form of sinful rebellion against an external reality that some simply do not want to answer to." End quote. Arguably, this is the heart of the popular online social media movement known as hashtag deconstruction. While many in the deconstructionist movement may not be familiar with formal postmodern thought or its origins, the idea of denying the historical aspects of traditional Christianity, employing the radically subjective hermeneutics of doubt and suspicion upon the Bible, defining truth as an amalgam of messy contradictions and mysterious unknowns, advocating that there is no one right way to think or live, are all fruits of the postmodern impulse, which continue to influence and inform our culture and its understanding of traditional Christian theology and practice. Here on part two of our discussion of postmodernism with philosopher and president of New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary, Dr. Jamie Dew, we pick up with how postmodernists answer Pilate's timeless question to Jesus, what is truth? Here again is Dr. Jamie Dew.
You'll hear people, critics of postmodernism, especially Christians, will want to critique them, and I get this. They'll say, you often hear Christian critics of postmodernism say, they reject truth. Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that they do reject correspondence theory, no question.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not to say that they don't have a, quote, theory of truth. And here, postmoderns will go one of two directions. They'll either go some kind of pragmatic view of truth or some kind of coherentist theory of truth.
Okay.
So you've got people like Richard Rorty that writes this article about solidarity I forget what the other one is, solidarity and uniformity or something like that. Uniformity is when we try to essentially gauge our theories of truth against what's there, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And solidarity is about the group thinking in one way.
Yeah.
So essentially what you've got here is a coherentism. Right.
Okay.
This statement is true if it coheres with the other things that we as a group believe.
If something is internally coherent, like Lord of the Rings, internally coherent, but not
right,
not necessarily objectively true.
That's correct. That's right. So coherentism, if the statement is true, or the statement is true if it fits with other things that we think to be true.
Okay.
Now, the problem with that is, you've raised a good one. I mean, think about any fiction.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I could read the Berenstain Bears, for example.
Internally coherent.
That's right. There's nothing in the story about Mama Bear and Papa Bear that really are wrong. They don't conflict with each other. The problem is bears don't live in trees and ride skateboards.
Or have, light and go to the grocery store.
Right.
And
they don't do this.
Right. Right.
So you got coherentism as one, and then the other one is pragmatism, or sometimes called instrumentalism.
Now, that was William James, John Dewey, mm-hmm. Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr.
Yep.
There was a whole philosophy of pragmatism in the U.S.
Yep.
Late 19th, early 20th century.
Yeah, some people would argue that pragmatism is America's sole philosophical contribution.
Well, I've heard people argue that Holmes Jr. and the justice system in the U.S. under Holmes and the pragmatist movement was in part, anyway, of the eugenics movement in Nazi Germany.
Yeah,
because Holmes was euthanizing people, using the court to euthanize people that were deemed that they didn't fit into society. So that whole pragmatism thing
was
a little scary.
Yeah, that's right. Know? Yeah, it can definitely become scary. Now, there's different forms of pragmatism, though. So, for example, your James, your Dewey's, and those. Dewey's is applying it to educational systems.
In a big way.
And by the way, just note how that's changed modern Western educational system, right?
Hmm.
If you're applying pragmatism to the educational system, what that's ultimately going to mean is education is for the purpose of helping you be equipped so you can get a good job, right? Well, think about how that shifts in the modern academy, students away from like a liberal arts approach to something, which was focused less on skill development and more on human development,
mm-hmm,
right,
mm-hmm,
by and large,
mm-hmm,
to more what we call STEM programs,
yeah,
science, technology, engineering, mathematics, where in those programs, nobody cares what kind of person you are. They
right.
just want to know that you can program the computer.
Crunch the numbers,
or something
man.
Like that.
Yeah.
So modern education has largely become a venue for you to go get credentials or go get training so you can get a job.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a mm-hmm. shift there that takes place. And obviously, when we go to a school, I'm not, as a president of a school, I don't ever want to say that your degree shouldn't help you in some way in what you're doing. But do I want to strip education to mere skill development and not human development? That seems deeply problematic to me. You had William James applying it to religion, right? Religious perspectives and truth claims mm-hmm. are going to be those which are useful to you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you do have a form of pragmatism, though, that I'm less critical of, I should say. I'd say it that way. I want to be very careful with this. And that is the pragmatism related to scientific theory, right? So Charles Peirce is developing a pragmatism about methodology. And this is really where something called abduction comes from.
Yeah.
So you've got
inference to the best explanation.
That's right. You got deduction,
mm-hmm.
right? You got induction, Francis Bacon. And then you got abduction. And some philosophers will say, look, abduction really just is a form of induction. And they're probably right about that. However, it's unique enough that we talk about it as a separate category. Abduction is the inference to the best explanation.
I've heard it say somebody in a colloquial way, abs like your gut hunch, like a good gut hunch, like you're going with what seems to be the best explanation. A lot of apologists use this.
That's right. Think about the way we typically defend the resurrection of Jesus.
Yeah.
The case we're making, whether people realize they're doing it or not, is an abductive case.
Right.
Attorneys in a court of law. I was just on a jury for a double murder.
Oh, dear.
And the prosecution made a case. It was textbook abductive reasoning. Textbook abductive reasoning. Mm. Doctors do it. When you go to a doctor and say, hey, my thumb hurts, I don't know what's going. So here's what it does. In regular induction, go back to Bacon for a second, you want to know what heat is? Bacon says, pay attention to the particulars. Start journaling and logging every conceivable detail you can find. And a pure inductive approach is very tedious. I mean, it's a lot of steps, a lot of process, right, and all this stuff, a lot of observation, a lot of experiments, a lot of data collection. Is it successful? Of course it is. Of course it is. Modern science is riding on that chassis right there. Problem is, we don't always have time to take that much time, right? Mm-hmm. And second of all, for those people that do certain types of things, they develop the ability to take some educated guesses.
Yeah.
So here's an example of abduction. So essentially you go into the doctor and you say, man, my side hurts. And the doctor asks you a few questions about the kind of pain that you've got. He asks you a few questions about some historical things, what happened here, here, and here. And then the doctor, because he's a medical doctor and he's studied the human body in and out for his entire career, knows the details of what could and could not be going on in there. He begins to postulate a couple possibilities. Well, it could be scar tissue. It could be a tumor. It could be a wound. It could be an infection. And those are, before he's done any explanations or any explorations at all or experiments, those are some educated guesses, some hypotheses. Now what he does is starts ordering tests. Well, I'm going to get a blood test to see if there's an infection. I'm going to do an image to see if I can see a tumor, right? And he's going to go through the testings and he's going to gather more data. Now what he's going to do is he's going to analyze his initial hypotheses of those four possibilities against the data he's got. Mm-hmm. And inference to best explanation is, as he gets more data, he doesn't see any lumps or masses in the imaging, so it's probably not a tumor, right? He doesn't see any infections in the blood, so it's probably not an infection. He's eliminating possibilities. And now you're down to, it's probably either scar tissue or some kind of injury. Did you get injured recently? Did you fall? Did you get hit or something like that? Nope, doc, I hadn't done any of those things. All right, it's probably not an injury. So now he's centered around the theory of, this is scar tissue, right? Mm-hmm. All right, that is called abduction and inference to best explanation often get talked about as the same thing. They're technically not. Abduction is the process of coming up with possible hypotheses. Inference to best explanation is on the back end of that, where now I start eliminating the inappropriate possibilities.
One further step of...
That's right.
Yeah, just going through...
But they go hand in glove,
yeah,
right?
Okay.
And so that comes from Charles Pierce. He formalizes that process. And essentially...
Charles Sanders Pierce, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, yeah.
So he's the one that's basically saying, hey, he's applying pragmatics to scientific theory or scientific method.
Which is a good thing.
That's right. That's a good thing.
That's a good thing.
That's a good thing. I'm glad my doctor can do that.
Mm-hmm.
And it certainly saves a lot of time and a lot of pain and a lot of money. So...
Right.
And now it speeds up the process.
It seems like, though, postmodernism, and maybe to some extent modernity as well, is suspicious of epistemic methodologies that don't yield testable results. The doc can test for these things that he hypothesized for. I've heard from critics that a lot of people walk away from Christianity. There's no way to test or prove history because Christianity is a historical religion. There's not the same kind of, you can say here all day long that it's abductive, but how do we go back and we test something that happened 2,000 years ago? I hear that complaint a lot.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't know how legitimate it is.
There, I get it, and there's a sense in which, certainly I'd have to grant, none of us can, but we can't do that with any historical thing, right? We can't go back in the sense, and what I mean by that is we can't go back and we can't live through those events against us, see with our own eyes if that actually happened. Sure, if that's what they mean by that, that's fine. But is that to say that no historical data whatsoever is of any value on any question?
You have to do abduction with the Bible itself. How did this come about?
And with anything. Certainly, I mean, postmoderns don't want to say stuff like that. I mean, look, what I wish I could do if I had the time is just follow them around in their life for a couple weeks.
And see if they live.
And notice how they'll make cases for things, and they'll point to things in the past or data in the past or something like that. I mean, that's just completely unlivable and contradictory to say that kind of thing, number one. Number two, there are other ways that we can triangulate. I mean, so maybe we can't step into a time machine and go back in time and live in the moment to see Jesus walking on water or something like that. Sure. But take the whole of our faith. There are things about our faith that we can posit some epistemic data from or some empirical data from. I mean, take the arguments for God's existence, for example. Yeah. I mean, the day for the atheist to say things like, well, there's no evidence for God's existence, those days are gone. Because these arguments that our brothers are making in the sciences and in philosophy on the arguments for God's existence, the cosmological, teleological arguments for beauty, moral arguments, ontological arguments at this point, my goodness gracious, they are so robust. And so for the atheist to sit around and say those things today, I just, you can't do that. What about personal testimony? This is a beef that I have. I know we're talking about postmodernism.
But no, but it does fit into the subjectivity that is comes into this discussion.
Well,
a little bit.
So the Enlightenment said the only evidence that matters or counts is empirical data or philosophical argument. And the Enlightenment said that, and I don't know, for a long time, if you're an evidentialist, apologetically, which for a long time I was, I guess you'd swallow that bait. And you'd take it and you'd say, that's right. Okay, so then I'll play by your rules. If the only thing that counts are philosophical arguments and evidence, and then I'll do that. And then we spend all this time. And look, I'm not knocking my friends and brothers that do that. I have done that. I still do that in some ways. I'm not saying that the evidence doesn't matter. I'm not a Kierkegaardian, you know. No, I'm not doing that. At the same time, the longer I've done this and the more I've grown up, when I look back on my own faith and my own walk with Christ, and students ask me, Jamie, why do you actually believe this stuff today? Well, if I'm honest with you, the reason I actually believe this stuff today has nothing to do with any of that, those arguments.
We don't come to Christ that way, it doesn't seem.
No, and frankly, it's none of that evidence that does that for me. I simply put, I believe this stuff today because I think that I have actually encountered Jesus Christ in some way. And he's changed my life. And I also, furthermore, there's something that happens to me in moments of corporate worship that I find myself caught up in belief and believing these things. And so as I look back, if I'm being honest about it, the reasons I actually came to belief and still do believe have nothing to do with these arguments or these evidences. They have to do with my experiences with Christ. Those experiences are real and they're precious to me.
Do you know who Neil Shenvey is?
I do.
Yeah, I
do.
I talked to Neil a couple of weeks ago on the podcast, and he laid out an argument in his book, Why Believe, that I thought was really impressive. You know, there's a lot of talk about justified true belief. Mm-hmm. What is a justified true belief philosophically, theologically? And he says he thinks Christians have a justified true belief for two reasons, if I'm representing him correctly. He says, we know there's something wrong with us, and we need to be saved.
Right.
He says, look at pop culture. Everybody's screaming to be saved from something, but it's usually a girlfriend or money or whatever where we look for salvation.
Right.
But he says, the Christian faith meets those things immediately.
Right.
I know I'm a sinner, I'm a wretch, and I know I need to be rescued.
Right. That's right.
And he said, this is why Christianity works. This is where people meet Jesus.
Yeah.
And these two points alone, that the atheist I'm reading about in Jana's book, same kind of experience. Something's wrong with the culture. Yeah. Something's wrong with me. I'm angry. I don't want to believe in God. I hope he's not the person that needs to rescue me, but there's nothing working.
Nothing. Yeah,
there's nothing else that can satiate this.
Well, as I look back on my life, I mean, to be candid, those are the reasons I actually believe. And so then I come back to these philosophical discussions and, you know, my world and my colleagues and that I have been having for all this time. And I believe because of these experiences, and yet in the Enlightenment and really a lot of Christian apologetics up to the present have been saying that, yeah, if you can't establish it with evidence, it's not a good idea.
Yeah.
And I'm going, says who?
Right.
Who is to say that the transformed life that has been brought in my life doesn't count as some kind of evidence? I don't know. So postmoderns want to make light of the evidence. They want to make light of the reasons that we believe. I think that they're much more robust than that. And
yeah.
They're not as easily dismissed as they would argue they are.
I want to riff on one of the phrases that you often hear thrown out there in postmodernism. Was it Rorty or Lotard, if I'm pronouncing that right? A suspicion of meta-narratives. You brought up meta-narratives before.
That's Lyotard, probably the one that wrote most profusely against meta-narratives.
Probably one of the most misunderstood phrases. I don't know. I'm not saying I understand it completely, but this idea of there being a suspicion toward an all-unifying narrative of reality.
Yeah.
But postmoderns still seem to retain a kind of meta-narrative when they're saying there are no meta-narratives, in some sense. That there's still a story to be told, even if it's using customs and traditions and language for oppression.
Yeah,
that's the meta-narrative of postmodernity. What is Lotard getting at here?
So I think what postmoderns are doing is they're giving us narratives, but not meta-narratives. So
on the
whole, this is a major motif of postmodernism, is the rejection or the death of the meta-narrative. So let's go back to the history. And this is why, by the way, we started today with modernity.
Mm-hmm.
In the Judeo-Christian world, God was the overarching explanation of reality.
The big picture.
The big picture. You explained everything with God and the Bible and Christianity, okay? The 17th century happens. You have the birth of modern science, modern philosophy, the age of science and reason, and it dethrones that religious meta-narrative and replaces it with a scientific meta-narrative. Okay, so now it's science and reason. It's the doctor in a lab coat that really gives us the real explanation, right? Well, postmodernity rejects not just the religious meta-narrative, but also the scientific meta-narrative. The difference between the Judeo-Christian era and modernity was not that one had a meta-narrative and the other one didn't. Both of them had meta-narratives.
Okay.
They just had different ones. God for Judeo-Christianity and science and reason for the Enlightenment. Postmodernity is rejecting all meta-narratives. Any person that comes across to you and says, I can explain it all, whether it's a preacher with a Bible or a scientist in his lab coat, that person is really just trying to make a power grab on you so he can manipulate you and control you. So it's a death to all overarching explanations of all things, right?
Mm.
Now, as we know, we just can't live that way. So what you get in postmodern community, there's an emphasis on community, mm-hmm. which is, by the way, part of the reason I think a lot of Christian folk are drawn to postmodernism is because it's big on community, which I think is just so foolish. My gosh, we were doing community long before postmoderns were doing community, you know? So
yeah.
Let's just get over that. We don't need them to help us understand how community works. But there's a big emphasis on community, and that individual community may have a narrative of its own, mm-hmm. but they would never be so arrogant, they would say, as to suggest that that's the overarching explanation of all things. There's another community over there, and they have this explanation, and another community over there, and they have that explanation. So what you get, I think, in postmodernism is individual communities or groups that have their own narrative, but they would never, ever, ever try to make it a meta narrative over and above everything else.
No imposition of narratives on somebody else.
That's right. Okay. We don't do that. That's arrogant.
So
in a sense, it
looks like they're not rejecting truth. They're creating truth for themselves, each of the communities.
That's correct. So you've got a coherent mm-hmm. or some kind of coherentist perspective or some kind of pragmatic perspective. And look, I would argue, like if I were putting my epistemologist hat on for a minute, when I critique postmodernism on that issue, the rejection of correspondence theory in place of coherentism or pragmatism, I want to be careful how I critique here, because coherentism and pragmatism are not invaluable. You know, they have a value to us.
Sure.
Epistemologically speaking,
mm-hmm.
if I believe something is true and it is in fact true, then it's probably going to be consistent with everything else I know, right? And it's probably going to be workable,
usable, and coherent.
That's correct.
Internally, yeah.
But I can come up with all kinds of usable things, and I can come up with all kinds of internally consistent things that aren't actually true. The Berenstain Bears, for example.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I read that when I was a little boy, and you know, Mama Bear and Papa Bear in the tree and stuff like that, and that's an internally consistent story. But bears don't live in trees, and that's not how it works. When I was a little kid, I was desperately afraid that the boogeyman was going to get me at night while I slept. So I slept with a baseball bat, and that baseball bat helped me. It worked for me. It pragmatically, it got me through the night, and I was able to sleep. And I woke up each morning going, yes, I made it.
Thy rod and thy staff.
That's right. And my bat got me through it. Now, as an adult, I obviously now can see that if there were a real boogeyman coming into my room and found a sleeping boy with a bat beside him, that bat would do absolutely nothing. That's not why I was safe.
Right.
Right. So it worked for me in some way, it pragmatically, but is that actually the reason I was safe? No, that's not true. So these things, so I like to say it this way, coherence and the workability, pragmatism, are necessary conditions for truth,
mm-hmm.
but they're not sufficient conditions for truth.
Yeah, they can't stand alone.
That's right. They right. have to have something more than that. And I think at the end of the day, correspondence is just way more resilient than we
sure.
let on.
Sure.
And by the way, all those folks, all those postmoderns, they live as though correspondence is true.
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. You're not going to walk across the street in downtown New Orleans unless you think
right.
Colors correspond to some
That's
reality
right.
that
That's
those
right.
other people are going to follow.
That's correct.
You know, so I think there is a – somebody had said, I don't know if it was Rorty or Lyotard, that he would write about postmodernity in a way that we normally just don't think or live. And then he would make an argument for some governmental position, or he would be clear and lucid, and he wouldn't be arguing in a postmodernity sense. He would be making connections, and
oh, that's right.
You know,
well, even you know, Derrida in his works where he writes on deconstruction. You know, I mean, the upshot of that whole movement is, hey, every text, every perspective, every position, every established idea that people write about, their writings contain contradictions and biases and blind spots that they don't even see, and
right.
it's the deconstructionist idea to come along and surface those and show how it all falls apart.
Mm-hmm.
What's very interesting is he conveyed all of that to us in written form.
That's right. Are you not saying Derrida isn't trying to say something
right.
through text?
Is he saying that we don't, number one, not understand what he's saying in that and not understand it perfectly what he's saying?
Mm-hmm.
So, look, I won't. There's some philosophy of language things going on that's motivating him to say that. I mean, there's some, to be candid, we live in a world filled with things that work that are super mysterious that we never pay attention to. Like, for example, here I am, I lift my arm. The mind-body questions of, like, what is the relationship between a mind, immaterial, and a body or brain that's material? How do causal interactions work in that? I don't know. But lo and behold, watch this. When my mind, I say, right arm, lift my arm, and boom, there it goes. It goes straight up.
It is amazing.
That's amazing.
It
and
really
that,
is.
That kind of freaks me out a little bit.
It does.
Language is kind of like this. When we get into the actual mysteries of how language works, language is kind of, it's an imperfect tool. We'll all grant that. But quite frankly, there's a lot about human language that shouldn't work. And that's really a lot of what's motivating Derrida and his writings on deconstruction.
Mm.
And I don't necessarily disagree with him on those things, but be that as it may, whatever those mysteries are and whatever those really fascinating things about what we don't know about how language is working is, if I say to my young son, hey, Samuel, go get me a popsicle, guess what happens? He jumps up out of his chair because he's a good-hearted little kid, and he runs over to the freezer and he gets a popsicle and he brings it back to me.
You're just like, wow, how did that happen?
Somehow, some way,
yeah.
My language succeeds despite the mysteries, despite the difficulties, despite the problems of language. Our language is normally, not always, but it is normally successful in conveying meaning. I mean, it's a notoriously difficult movement and attitude, really, to define and to get at. But there are some motifs, and
mm-hmm.
There is the book that Stuart and I did. I mentioned this at the very beginning. Stuart wrote most of that book, and that's good news because he's a much better philosopher than I am. So check that book out.
It's called Understanding Postmodernism with Stuart E. Kelly and Jamie Dew.
Yep.
A Christian Perspective, eminently readable, I think. It's on IVP Academic, came out in 2017.
Yep.
Excellent book on this. If you have friends or people that are struggling with this modern evangelical concept of what we call deconstruction, which is not Jacques Derrida's deconstruction,
yeah,
but it's
right.
coming out of that.
That's right.
The reassembling of the self and meta-narratives
That's
and
right.
being suspicious of truth and
yep.
those kinds of things. So thank you so much for your time, Jamie.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Every so often, we here at Apologetics Profile have the opportunity to offer a fortunate listener a free copy of the book featured on our episode. This week, we will be giving away a copy of Postmodernism, a Christian Primer. Just send me an email with a current mailing address to dray, that's D-R-A-Y, at watchman.org. That's dray at watchman.org. We will randomly select someone from the submissions and ship you a copy free of charge. Unfortunately, for this offer, we cannot ship outside the continental United States. Thanks for tuning in this week and for Watchman Fellowship and Apologetics Profile. I'm Daniel Ray.